We're going to call to order the meeting of the Senate Committee on Education. Today is March 3rd, 2015. And just so the record shows, because I look fairly alone up here, today's floor session went very long, and I encouraged each and every one of our other members to go get some lunch and eat a little bit, because the days go on quite long here. So they will be back shortly. The beginning of our meeting today is one in which we have information being given to us in an informational hearing, and that can proceed without everybody, so I can get going. And because we've given about 45 minutes, we do want to have time at the end to take care of a few other actions that we have later. So with that, we will open up an informational hearing. Regarding the role of the technical and regional universities in achieving our 40-40-20 goals. So with that, I'll invite Chris Maples, Jay Keaton, Mark Wise, and Roy, however you want to sit yourselves up there and arrange yourselves, I would love to have. Just so as we're getting started, I have met with all of you individually, and I think it was important in those conversations that we have a real conversation with the rest of Oregon, and that's what we're hoping to do start today, about how you see yourselves fitting in. And I think it'll be informational to a lot of people about how important a role you have to play in this part of our educational endeavor. So with that, I'll let you proceed any way you wish to start.
Thank you, Chair Roblin, and good afternoon. And for the first time ever, I don't follow that with "and members of the committee."
Right. They'll be here shortly.
For the record, my name is Chris Maples, and I'm president of Oregon Institute of Technology, a.k.a. Oregon Tech. You will be introduced to my colleagues later as they speak. With the brief time we have today, I would like to talk about the Oregon's technical and regional universities, the true universities, and give you a quick overview of who we are, where we are now with system changes, our commitments, along with what we need to help achieve the important outcomes that we are seeking in order to move us forward with 40-40-20. We are access point universities. There is absolutely no doubt that there is so much access that comes to the true universities in the state. Many of our students come from rural areas across the state, and we hear every day from them and their families that if we weren't around, they would not be able to go to some of the schools. They just would not get a degree if we weren't around. So we're situated in very rural areas. Our faculty focus is not so much research, it really is teaching, and it primarily is teaching at the undergraduate level, so that we really are getting a lot of one-on-one and small group contact between our faculty and students who really need it. We have a very broad geography in the state, from LeGrand to Klamath Falls to Ashland to Monmouth to Wilsonville, and along the coast as well, with centers that Eastern Oregon has. I would tell you that broad geography also results in a lot of regional economic impact in areas of the state that really need it the most. Central to our core belief is partnerships with K-12 and the community colleges, because we are in various places around the state. We have lots of opportunity with lots of the community colleges as well. And you have heard or will hear about all kinds of examples along these lines. Eastern Oregon University's Eastern Promise Program, our dental hygiene partnership with Chemeketa Community College here in Salem, the Southern Oregon University Pirates to Raiders Program, and Western Oregon's University's Cesar Chavez Leadership Institute. What I would also tell you is that collectively, the TRUs serve over 20,000 students, more than 80% of whom are Oregonians, and that we have consciously really worked to make sure that we are serving Oregonians, and we are serving Oregonians where they live. Because our students are from so many rural areas of the state, which now reflect some of the most economically distressed parts of Oregon, nearly three-quarters of our students are Pell Grant eligible. And you can think of Pell Grant eligible as being a proxy for being low income. 50 to 60% of our students are the first in their families to go to college. And for them, getting a degree is not just an opportunity, but it's a way of changing the entire lifestyle of a family structure going forward. These are the kinds of students that require substantially more personal contact and therefore more staff and smaller student-faculty ratios to get them to graduation. That's what we provide. But it takes that kind of effort. A lot of really high-flying students can teach themselves and can do so in large places with minimal faculty input often. These are students that need the help, and they need to have us involved, and we are committed to them. Because of that, in terms of outcome, together the TRUs produced more than 3,600 degrees last year, covering STEM, STEAM workforce needs in Oregon. And our campuses are producing teachers, engineers, health professionals, scientists, social workers, chemists, and many other important degrees and roles in our communities across the state. And finally, together we represent about $140 million of the public university's appropriation of $560 million. Despite the fact that we have small classes and additional staff in order to get students through who need that help, we run really lean operations, and operations that focus on the student's success. And I think you're going to hear a lot about that from my colleagues as we go right to left here, or left to right as you see it. And I will let them introduce themselves, starting with the interim president of Eastern Oregon University, Jay Kenton.
Thank you, Chris, and Chair Roblin. For the record, my name is Jay Kenton. I'm the interim president at Eastern Oregon University. And it's perhaps ironic that I go second today because OIT, or Oregon Tech, pardon me, beat our women's basketball team last night for the conference championship. So, and I think he even has part of my property in his pocket, but we won't dwell on that too much today. Anyway, as a group of institutions, we're going through a fairly tumultuous change right now, probably one of the largest changes in the 85 or 86 year history of the Oregon University system, you know, with new governing boards, with the dissolution of the chancellor's office, et cetera. It brings challenges as well as opportunities to each of our institutions. As we move forward in this new decentralized higher education landscape with institutional boards, I want you to know that the four of us and our institutions are committed to collaborating and sharing services in ways which enrich us collectively and gain efficiencies that lower cost. And I would even extend that to the seven of our institutions. We continue to collaborate with Oregon State, Portland State, University of Oregon. We meet as a council of presidents. We share services with one another today, and it has been a very rich and effective relationship. One of our biggest concerns, however, is this university shared services enterprise that has been in effect for about a year now, something that I set up in my waning days as the Vice Chancellor of Finance and Administration. And the cost of that, you know, the cost of the chancellor's office going away and, you know, having to pick up those services directly is not insignificant. In fact, we estimate that cost to be around $12 million a biennia for the four of our schools, which is about roughly $1.5 million per school per year in additional costs to pick up the payroll, the risk management, some of the accounting, financial reporting, the treasury services, and collective bargaining, things like that, that for years have been provided by the Oregon University system or the chancellor's office. So now those costs are coming to each of us, and we are grappling with that and are hopeful that there will be additional funding provided to help offset those costs. I know that all four of us are very excited about our new governing boards. And in fact, all of us have had multiple meetings with our governing boards. And, you know, it's very interesting to have a board comprised of people from your region. All of my board members at Eastern Oregon are from Eastern Oregon. They understand the issues, they understand the opportunities, and I think they will hold the institution accountable to serving that region and the people thereof. And so I think it will be a great benefit, not just to our institution, but to our students and to our region, hopefully extending beyond that, even into the economy of the region, et cetera. So we're very optimistic and very excited about that new opportunity that has been provided. I think that's about all I'm going to say right now. I'll be back, but I'm going to pass now to my right to Mark Weiss, the president of Western.
Thank you, Senator Roblin and Administrator Engbring. For the record, my name is Mark Weiss, and I'm president at Western Oregon University. We're here today to ask your help for helping our students succeed. We respectfully request that you consider what an adequate public higher education budget means for Oregonians. If the public universities were funded at the level of the governor's recommended budget of $624 million for the biennium, that would still be about $70 million less than the seven public universities were funded in the 2007-2009 biennium. And we now have 20,000 more students than we did in 2007-2009. To emphasize that point, we now have 20% less funding and 20% more students. That translates to a gap that must be filled by tuition increases with unintended consequences. That means limited access because of affordability for Oregonians. At Western in 2008, we adopted the immensely popular Western Oregon University fixed-rate tuition promise. We have kept our promise to our students, and seniors are graduating at among the very lowest rates, tuition rates, in the state of Oregon. That is not the case for incoming freshmen, as their rates have increased disproportionately. State disinvestment in higher education appears to have become the new normal, and we appreciate the indications that many are trying to reverse that trend. Some ask, what would you do with more funding to achieve increased degree outcomes? We would invest in our students. We are asking for your help to ensure that there is a balance between new financial aid resources and robust on-campus student success infrastructure. At Western, that includes investing in our quality teaching faculty to attract and retain with market-based salaries. Financial aid increases are critical to students, but must be balanced with support on campus for their success. At Western, one of the ways we balance that equation is to increasingly provide tuition remissions as need-based aid to our students. Those funds can only come from state reinvestment in public higher education or by increasingly raising costs for those able or willing to achieve a higher debt load for themselves. As you are aware, the student debt crisis is among one of the next bubbles ready to burst in the United States. It is imperative that once a student decides to come to one of our campuses, we have the quality faculty and staff to maximize their opportunity to succeed. We are morally obligated to provide a tight web of advising, tutoring, mentoring, retention programs, and the like, so our students avoid the ultimate disaster, dropping out without a degree but with a mountain of debt. Over the last decade, each of our campuses have added and cut or curtailed outreach and retention, related staff as we try to save academic programs from harm and related staff. This has not been without major impacts on our campuses, and our enrollment, retention, and graduation rates are directly tied to the amount and quality of support services we have on our campuses so Oregonians succeed on each of our campuses. We must stop the vicious cycle that impacts too many students and their families who struggle with financial, academic, and life's issues. Without staff, we lose those students in the hundreds on an annual basis. At Western, we have been nationally recognized for increasing the gap between graduation rates of our Latino student population and the rest of our student body by some 9%, where our Latino student bodies are now graduating at a higher rate. This investment in success has come with tuition increases that have been too steep during the period 2009 through 2013. We are also asking for your help to make our transitions to a new governance model successful. We know you want this to be successful or you wouldn't have passed the reform legislation last session. Helping us transition costs that Jay Kenton talked about is how we can ensure that this major reform will be seen historically as the best thing that occurred in Oregon in the 85 years since the seeds of the Oregon University system were founded, and not a pivotal event that degrades the campuses who serve Oregon's rural, underserved, and low-income populations. The Trues appreciate the funding for sports lottery as well that's in the budget. I wish we could change the name of this program from sports lottery to something else because it's so much more about academic and lifelong success than it is about winning on the field. For Western, the only NCAA Division II team in Oregon, it means life in the balance. A balance of academic service and athletics coupled with an education in lifelong management skills to balance life after college. Athletics opens doors and access to college for many young men and women in Oregon who end up being among the most successful academically at our campuses. At Oregon Tech, for example, athletes' average GPA is over 3.2. At Western, our retention rates from year to year for student athletes are over 90%, considerably higher than the rest of our student body. Nearly half of our student athletes receive scholarships from sports lottery sources, and more than half of those receiving scholarships are female student athletes. At Western, approximately $400,000 annually provides aid for scholarships for approximately 150 student athletes and graduate students. It funds programs that retain students at higher rates to graduation, supports Title IX equity in women's sports offerings, and provides a positive economic benefit across the state as our teams and visiting teams travel to other campuses using hotels, restaurants, and other services along the way. Lastly, we'll be talking to you in detail later on in the session about our capital requests. We have included in your materials a summary of those requests for the 7 public universities. The Trues are not campuses that are spending money on lavish facilities so that we can compete nationally. We are focused on funding instructional facilities that ensure our students are well prepared for the world of work and able to contribute on day one. The consolidated request for deferred maintenance, a item priority number one, funding, although inadequate to solve the long list of issues on our campus due to decades of insufficient funding for adequate maintenance and repair, is greatly appreciated. And even more is necessary to protect aging facilities and provide necessary accommodations for all our students and staff. Thank you. And now, President Sagel from Southern.
Senator, Chair Roblin, committee members, my name is Roy Sagel, interim president of Southern Oregon University, and I'm here to kind of pick up a summary of what my colleagues had presented to you. It's curious that in my 6 months here that I have been able to observe from 40,000 feet up the issues that confront some of the TRUs and also the three bigs in the state of Oregon. I believe that as regional and technical institutions that we service a part of society that is oftentimes forgotten in the mainstream of higher education. We are number 47 in the state, and that we need to rectify the concerns that we have. Having also been a first-generation university graduate of Oregon State, we must remember that the cost for out-state service to students, for new immigrants, for people who have been first-time generation college goers, for people who are underserved, generally in this category, people do not even have the energy or the wherewithal or the knowledge to ask for help. And so consequently, as President Maples has said, we need additional support for financial aid, for counseling, for advising, for mentoring, and that we are very, very serious about linking and developing a seamless relationship with high schools as well as community colleges. We want to make sure that the time that is spent in high schools and CCs are well spent and that are able to communicate into the four-year institution without any difficulty at all. And this takes communication that we have been spending time, and I know my colleagues and I both have been meeting with community college presidents and staff. We have been meeting with principals and superintendents of schools. This had been happening previous. However, because of the difficulties we've been seeing, we are putting very serious time and effort into that seamless pathway for our students. We know that if they take at least 9 credits, that they will persist into university work. And consequently, we want to make sure that they are successful when they come to our institutions. We are very, very serious about the kinds of things that our students have to do. We did a survey on Southern Oregon University. The number one retention and graduation category are students who work on campus. Second, as Mark and others have said, athletics. These kids are not professionals. When I was at Chancellor at Auburn University, they all wanted to become professionals. These kids want to come and play sports for another 2 or 3 years. We started a soccer program. This allows for minorities and others to play. And also, I still can't get my arm around it, but we started a women's wrestling team. We have, I understand, 1,000 women wrestlers from Northern California to the Canadian border. Now, athletes, including football players, are the second criteria for retaining and graduating from the university. And as Mark said, their incoming grade point is higher, their retention from freshman and sophomore is much higher, and their grade point is higher than the average student on campus. So again, the sports authority type support is extremely important for our kind of student. We are very, very interested in keeping the 40-40-20 going, and that's why we have worked so diligently, and we have our vice presidents working with the VPs of the CCs to make sure that we do not leave a stone unturned. We are very serious about the high quality of education. Although we are teaching more, we are doing dual enrollment courses with high schools, we are linking up with the community colleges, we want to ensure that the students who come through our universities have the quality that when they graduate, they can go right on and work for the industries or the teaching or the bureaucracies that encompass our state. We are very, very keen and trying to provide for the education of the middle class of this state and this country. And so with that, I will close. Thank you.
Thank you.
And we have a thank you, and you have supplemental material. We won't go through it in the interest of time. We are very happy to answer questions, any and all of us, if there are any from the chair of the committee.
Any questions from all the people?
Or go into more detail.
I have a couple, and I know that you offer some. I was checking with this with the others. Technical certificates and other non-degree programs. So they're not going to necessarily come out of the program with a four-year degree, but they do have, there are other technical certificates and others that are offered. Tech or offers them.
Chair Roblin, members of the committee, that is correct. We have some technical certificates. We have an associate's degree, a couple of associate's degree that we offer in conjunction with OHSU, as it turns out. Things that OHSU decided that they did not want to focus on as they worked more toward graduate and professional degrees that they were doing. So we have a joint degree in paramedic, and we have one that's a joint degree that we are doing with the former ODS, now MODA, in dental hygiene as an associate's degree as well.
Okay. Are there any of the other programs?
Yeah, we also have a number of certificates and other degree programs, and a number of what I'd call 2+2 programs with, like, Oregon State's on our campus. We have a couple of ag programs that you do the first 2 years at Eastern, second 2 years at OSU, and you get an OSU ag degree out of that. We have programs with OHSU where they do the first 2 years of nursing at Eastern, the final 3 years at Eastern, but with enrolled at OHSU and get an OHSU nursing degree. We have a 2+2 with OIT as well in dental hygiene, where, again, 2 years at Eastern, 2 years at OIT gets you a degree in dental hygiene. We also have very strong relationships with community colleges. We actually offer programs on 11 community college campuses around the state: Umpqua Community College, Southwest Oregon Community College, Chemeketa Community College, Clatsop Community College, Portland Community College, Clackamas Community College, Mount Hood Community College, Central Oregon Community College, as well as, obviously, Blue Mountain Community College in Pendleton and Treasure Valley Community College in Ontario.
So we also have some certificate programs, but what I'd like to speak about is something that's a little bit unique and coming on in Oregon, and that's the Applied Baccalaureate degree. And this is where someone who may have 6 or 8 or 10 years experience, I'll give you an example, someone who might be working in a nursing home but doesn't have the degree but does have some college credits, maybe from a community college or a four-year institution. So we have a Applied Baccalaureate degree that will allow them to get their four-year degree in 2 years. We have one in gerontology that's in our psychology department. We have one in it's in our criminal justice department. Basically, and we have about 5 in total, and these allow people with work experience that don't have the four-year degree to get their four-year degree in short order.
Thank you, Mark. And Chair Roblin, we just started a leadership and innovation program at the HEC at Medford, and that started with a contingent of 20 cohort groups. These are individuals who are middle managers who are able to get credit for their previous experience as well as go once a week to get their degree. And so it's been very popular, and we're trying to get it online for next time. Those are issues that are very, very important. Another sidelight, as I look at universities and regional institutions and technical institutions, we all give some sort of certificates, and we do too. But the other thing that is oftentimes overlooked is that early on, institutions try to innovate, create new ideas, create new entities. And sometimes we are overlooked in this part by forgetting where we began. And in 1935, we started the Oregon Shakespeare Festival. We started the Brett Theater. We started the Chamber Concert Series. We have many of these kinds of things that create jobs, but they're not the production of just the widgets that we think about. These institutions are so valuable to the regions that we represent. We bring in colleagues, we bring in ideas, we bring in innovation, and look at all the jobs and actors and restaurant people who enjoy the finer things of Ashland and Medford area. So sometimes we would like also to understand that we create an atmosphere of intellectual foundation. We also allow for creative thinking and to allow for new ideas where none existed before. So again, I think we all represent a very, very fine part of this state, and we ask for your help to support us to do even more. Thank you.
And to pick up, Chair Roblin, on that innovation thing and to tie this back up, one of the other things that we collectively do, because we focus on the community colleges and our undergraduate success, many of us have started reverse transfer programs with community colleges in which a student will leave a community college before he or she has his or her degree, take the classes that would have gotten their degree with us, we transfer them back, they get a degree from the community college, and statistics show that that level of success leads to additional success and enhanced finishing of bachelor's degrees potentially as well. And it helps the state's 40-40-20.
And the other question I guess I have, we heard from early testimony that at least in one of the schools, 90% of the kids that are in sports are retained to the next year, so there was pretty high retention rate. Does that follow through all the way to graduation rate? Are they graduating at significantly higher rates than would the general population? And are you attributing part of your success with your Latino students that they have activities as well as the academic stuff for them to be successful and stay there? Because I know you had a
yes,
amazing results there as well.
Well, the 90% number that I quoted was year to year, but not and the other typically to graduation we measure a 6-year to graduation rate, and it's certainly not 90%. I wish
right.
It was.
I wish it were too.
In fact, for our entire student body, it's something under 50%, which frankly needs to be improved. And for our student athletes, it is higher than the rest of our student body, just like I explained how our Latino students graduate at a rate higher. And that's because I think for our student athletes, it's because of the coaches' involvement, the extra involvement that the coaches have in their academic life as well as their life on the field. And it's like, you know, the Division II motto is life in the balance, and it's really a combination of proper time management and in order to make everything happen and happen well. So we see students that are higher grade point averages and go through our system quicker than our student athletes, yes.
Yes. Thank you.
So, yes.
Thank you. I just wanted to take a second to express my gratitude to Mr. Kenton. He was the long-time institutional knowledge and expert on he was actually the money man for the higher system of higher education for many, many years, and I think he was just about ready to retire. This opening came up, and he took on some challenges that only he was really qualified to take on. So I just wanted to say we appreciate your service very much.
Thank you, Senator. It's very much appreciated.
We also appreciate that he failed at retirement.
And I guess last thing I would... Oh.
If I may, I'd just like to add one more point about the Eastern Promise. This is a program that EOU started with Blue Mountain Community College, Treasure Valley Community College, and then Intermountain ESD, which is ESD in Pendleton, and Malheur ESD in Malheur County in Ontario. And, you know, we got a $2.2 million grant from the State Department of Education to pilot this program. It started 3 years ago. Part of the grant required that we do some evaluation of the results. And so we just recently received a report, two reports actually, one from Education Northwest that evaluated the results of the program, and then the other from Eco Northwest that evaluated the return on investment. And this is a program where we go into the high schools, we have professional learning communities, work with their faculty, make sure they're qualified to teach, and then they teach college credit for us. And the one thing, there's three or four points I just want to make, because I'm very proud of this, and it's something that I think should be replicated around the state to the extent as possible. The first is it increased the graduation rates of the kids that took an Eastern Promise credit in high school. 99% of those kids graduated from high school. Now, that's compared to an 80% regional graduation rate and a 68% statewide graduation rate, 99%. They also found that the absentee rates of those children went down. They were more engaged, more interested, and they came to school more because of it. And then finally, they found that more of them went on to college as a result of having those pre-college credits in high school. So then we ask Ed Northwest, John Topanga's group, to look at that and to think about the economic impact. There was a $2 million investment, as I said, from the state. What's the return on that investment? The return was 64-1. What he did was took those incremental college graduates, extended their lifetime earnings, and then net present valued that, and then put that back into tax income to the state, and the return was 64-1 for every dollar spent. So I think it's a great program. I would encourage us to do it more. I think, getting those, and it also saved the family, by the way, millions of dollars, because we charge $10 a credit hour for those credits that are taught to the families. So it's kind of a win-win program. We're very proud of it. I know it's being replicated around the state, and I think it's something, if we really want to get at 40-40-20, that we need to think about very, very strongly. Thank you.
I think it leads really well to our next conversation that we're going to have. But I also want to say thanks to all of you. You are not in the easiest positions in our state right now with respect to just making sure that all of these institutions succeed. There are a lot of efforts and a lot of issues happening with you all the time and your individual boards, all those kinds of things. I think for me it was a good understanding that it's about $1.5 million of extra work you've taken on since the Chancellor's office left. Not doing those same kinds of things that are now responsible for you, and it would be nice to have that money follow. That was important information for me as well. And I, again, applaud you for taking over Eastern. They've had their issues with respect to the finances for a number of years. It's great to have you in that position to look at that and figure out how to move forward. So
it's been a wonderful opportunity, and Eastern will succeed.
There we go. That's good. Thank you all.
Thank
Thanks.
You.
Thank you. Thank you.
So we'll close our informational hearing and on the technical and regional universities, and we are going to open a public hearing on Senate Bill 84. And who do we want to have come up first? Oh, there we go. There's Hilda. Hilda Roselli, can come on up. And Allison, go this order.
Sure. Yeah.
And David Gray. We'll have you all three come up to begin with. Yep.
So good afternoon, Senator Roblin, Chair, and members of the committee. For the record, my name is Hilda Roselli. I serve as the College Career Readiness Director for the Oregon Education Investment Board, and I have to say my heart was pounding positively listening to the last presentation, because I spent 10 years at Western Oregon and loved every minute of it and miss it today. I am here today to just clarify something that may be helpful for the committee. We know that sometimes language can give a perception, and we wanted to make sure that we were very clear in highlighting something that may have been misinterpreted. And this is referencing students' access to online online coursework that is referenced in Senate Bill 84. And I wanted to just start by mentioning that the original language in the bill, Section 2.3a, was written to say courses offered through an accelerated college credit program may be supported by online resources, but a course may not be exclusively provided online. This reflected some discussion in the committee, not that they were opposed to online coursework. They were concerned about the success factor for students and needing that extra support besides saying, well, there's a course, you could enroll in it. And so we attempted to deal with this in the edits, -1 amendments, by adding or substituting language that says courses may be supported by online resources, but a course provided exclusively online must be supported by on-person or in-person activities targeted to improving the success of students in the course. And we've looked a lot at what the research tells us. There's some very interesting reports that have been done, particularly for looking at students who may be less motivated to independently carry on with their online education. And I reference a report from the North American Council for Online Learning that has looked at a number of programs, including one that was in place in Salem-Keizer. It used to be called the Bridge Program, and they've now adopted a new system of online classes. But they are reaching students who typically may have been under-motivated in their high school coursework. But one of the things that I've learned in talking with the assistant principal at one of the high schools that's offering a lot of this coursework is that she said, you know, 15 and 16-year-olds need an extra amount of encouragement and support to be successful in those online learning environments. And that was what the intention of that amended language was. And if the assistant principal and the online instructor are willing to come and meet with you all and testify, if that's of use to you in the future. Thank you.
And before we go on to the next, I just want to say this is a carryover from a couple meetings ago, and we had a number of people we ran out of time, didn't have the time. And so I want to thank you, Hilda, for coming back and kind of putting in place some of the other things that we were talking about at that
Certainly, time. It's my pleasure.
So with that, we'll take the rest of the testimony. So
great.
Go right ahead.
Great. Chair Roplin and members of the committee, thank you for giving me the opportunity to testify today on Senate Bill 84 and the impact on preventing college credits earned by students if taken via fully online. For the record, my name is Allison Galvin. I'm the high school lead principal at Oregon Connections Academy, or ORCA. Our school opened its doors in 2005, and we have grown to be Oregon's largest online public charter school, serving over 39 students. In fact, we're the largest school in Oregon right now. In the past 10 years, our students have had many successes in school due to our amazing teachers and the programs we have been able to implement. One of these programs that's near and dear to me is our College Now, or our dual credit program. We're currently in our third year with dual credit opportunities, and we partner with Linbitten Community College. Over the last 3 years, our ORCA students have earned over 1,780 college credits. And currently, 115 of our currently enrolled students have already earned 641 college credits. Dual credit is a critical component of our high school. When we discuss students being college and career ready, as we're equally committed to the 40-40-20 initiative, along with a rigorous curriculum aligned to standards, the best way for students to see college as a viable and realistic option is to begin building that college transcript while still in high school. I'd love to hear the gentleman from Eastern Oregon speaking, because we've actually have met with them as well, and they have a great program. And not just any teacher or any high school course aligns with college curriculum and meets the requirements for being a dual credit course. I'm sure you're aware, but just to summarize, the first layer of getting approval to be a dual credit course is that the teacher must meet the minimum requirements to be a college professor. They must have 27 graduate courses minimum credits, 27 graduate credits in the designated field. If the college says, okay, we've looked at their transcript, they qualify, Then the course goes through a very, very elaborate alignment process where student materials, student work, course objectives, all of those items are aligned with the college course. If the college can say with fidelity that the course is aligned, then the course is approved for dual credit. Oregon Connections Academy has successfully made it through the teacher and course approval for 19 courses. While it is a great accomplishment, not every course that we've tried to get approved or every instructor has made it through that approval process. There are two important groups that I would like to mention enrolled in this program at Oregon Connections Academy. The first are students who qualify for free and reduced meals, so our farm students. In the last 3 years, we've had 35 free and reduced meal eligible students earn an average of almost 5 credits each. And I think that's a big win for students that are economically disadvantaged and a huge savings for their family. The second group of students are our rural high school students. Over 8% of our high school population are from rural communities, and many of these students are from communities who have no additional dual credit options. Our school provides access for them to get a head start and provide equity for our rural students. Finally, college credit can also mean scholarship awards. Oregon Connections Academy last school year, our seniors so what we know about over $500,000 in scholarships. Out of those seniors, all but one was part of our dual credit program. Because of the rigorous program where both the instructor and the course must meet requirements of being a college course, hundreds of Oregon Connections Academy students have been enrolled in this program and have earned credit. In your packet is a document outlining the dual credit program, but also everything we do at ORCA to support college and career readiness. It also outlines the success of other public online schools like ours and the recognition that fully online students receive from colleges and universities across the country. It is important that Oregon students not be disadvantaged by policies that limit access. This is a critical program not only for our high school students, but also for our Oregon University system, having our students come more prepared for college. In closing, I'd like to tell just a brief story about a student we had with Oregon Connections Academy named Brooklyn. She's currently a senior at a school in Wisconsin, but she was a student of ours for a couple of years. Last year, she was able to earn 8 college credits through our dual credit program. That's great, and certainly not the most we've had a student earn, but what's unique about Brooklyn is that her and her mom were homeless all last year. And typically our homeless population has a very difficult time accessing post-high school opportunities. And Brooklyn was able to, even through the trials in their home life, access 8 college credits and do so successfully. She keeps in contact with her AP English language teacher, and she just shared last week that she's been accepted at Oregon State University, and they moved to Wisconsin because they had family housing and were able to have a place to live. And so she's excited to get back to Oregon State, Oregon, and go to OSU and be a Beaver, and she attributes that all to seeing that she can take college credits. She can be part of that community and do more and do more than what she's currently had in her situation. We fully support Senate Bill 84 with the same mention you made. The courses offered through an accelerated college credit program may be supported by online resources, but a course may not be exclusively provided online. I would just like to say, if we could cut off those last 9 words, but a course may not be exclusively provided online. Like I said, we've had such great success, 245 students earning credit, almost 1,800 credits awarded. It's been a huge, huge success in our program, and those words cut our program completely out. So I appreciate that, Chair Roblin, the members of the committee. Thank you again for letting me share my passion for our dual credit program.
Thank you. Yes. Go ahead.
Chair,
we'll have questions for everybody.
I'm sorry.
After. I said we'll go ahead and then afterwards have questions.
Sure. Chair Roblin and members of the committee, my name is David Gray. I am the CEO and principal of Metro East Webb Academy. We're stationed in Gresham, Oregon, part of the Gresham-Bartow School District. We're approximately 500 students, full and part-time. We have around 130 of our students that are actually involved in an early college program or our dual credit program or the college now. We recently aggregated our results from the first quarter of the college term, and our students earned over 1,400 credit hours in that single quarter, and approximately a fifth of those were over 100, almost 200 hours in our College Now program. Our purpose today, and I encourage you to read the testimony of one of our students. I believe she wrote you a letter, Siobhan Christensen, and Christina Strickbon is going to testify later on, and she's one of our teachers that teaches in the College Now program. But what I want to encourage you to think about is that online is not a term that you can generalize across the board. Many of our students, because of the way we deliver online education, come to our facility. We have 10,000 square feet. So there is some face-to-face instruction, but we could get caught up in the online definition of how it's defined in Senate Bill 84. So our teachers and our students will be face-to-face in some instances. They'll be online in some instances, or a combination of both. So that's our concern. And we also want to speak to the fifth-year senior component of the bill. Many of our students come to us credit deficient. For whatever reason, they were not successful in traditional brick-and-mortar schools. They feel disenfranchised, disempowered, disenchanted. And so our job is to get those kids caught up and graduate on time, hopefully. But many times, that's a pretty big chore to do in 4 years. So the fifth-year program is really important to us. And with the 40-40-20 program, our kids have an opportunity to earn college credits in the College Now, in the early college program. And sometimes it takes 5 years. I don't want to be redundant what you heard already. I want to echo the testimony of the other presenters up here. But I do want to encourage you to think about changing the language in Amendment 2 and Amendment 3, understanding that not all online programs are equal. Thank you.
Any questions for these people? Thank you very much. So next we'll have Bobby Jaeger, Tracy Schworn, and I think I'll go with the person that's over 125, Jeff Dentz.
Good afternoon, Chair Roblin and members of the committee. My name is Tracy Sharn, and I'm a librarian at Western Oregon University. I'm also the chair of the statewide Information Literacy Advisory Group of Oregon. And I'm here today to talk about library support for accelerated learning programs. College students who take their courses at a college or university have access to college-level resources to do research related to their studies and a librarian to teach them how to do research. This is especially important in core freshman classes that prepare students for upper division coursework. As accelerated learning has expanded, there has been a gap noticed in the access of high school students to college-level materials and a librarian to teach them how to do research to be successful in their academic endeavors. ILAGO, the group that I represent, conducted a national survey to find out how other states dealt with this. You've been provided with a copy of that report. Briefly, we found that the best way to address these gaps was to provide students in accelerated learning programs with access to a college-level article database through a statewide program, and a licensed school librarian to teach these students how to do research. Oregon does have a statewide database program, but it's constrained by its mission to serve the widest possible number of library patrons, from a student in elementary school who's doing a presentation on otters, to a homeowner who is looking at Consumer Reports to figure out the best things to purchase for their home. An additional concern is that the lowest bid for the statewide contract usually wins. The result is that the Gale databases that we currently have access to are not considered sufficient for college-level research. Instead, most colleges and universities in Oregon go to an EBSCO company to get their article databases. And in fact, the statewide program did recently enact a subsidy to help colleges and universities do that. That statewide program is funded through federal money, not through state money. Licensing requirements prohibit colleges from allowing students to access the databases that they subscribe to on behalf of their students unless those students are formally enrolled in that college. A statewide subscription to a college-level article database would solve that problem. Students also need access to a licensed school librarian to teach them how to do research. That's their subject content area, and that's what they're experts in. Accelerated learning programs are intended to encourage students to finish not just high school, but continue on to become college students and persist to get a degree. Research has shown that students who are connected to supportive services are more likely to succeed academically. And research has also shown that library resources and library instruction play a key role in helping students in terms of retention and persistence to a degree. Thank you.
Thank you.
If I shiver, it's because I'm cold. Senator Roblin and members of the committee, first, thank you for your service to all of Oregon's students. For the record, my name is Bobby Jaeger. I'm the executive director of BEST, Building Excellent Schools Together. I am also Oregon's Mother of the Year for 2012. But first and foremost, I'm the mother of 13 children. I have 8 sons and 5 daughters, and before you ask me, I had them all. So yes, I still am and have been an advocate for school choice and education for many years. The term accessibility was emphasized quite a bit last Tuesday in relation to Oregon's 40-40-20 model and in discussions around Senate Bill 84. There are 20 online programs in Oregon, one of them being Oregon Connections Academy, who has students in 168 school districts here in Oregon. They are only one of the 20 programs, and I do hope that they echo the same concerns that I have today with not allowing dual credit courses of 100% online courses. Online dual credit courses are an access for the many rural students they serve. That includes my family. For many urban students with a wide range of needs, that includes my family. For those employed students that want to expand their future for job opportunities and need a flexible schedule, this also includes my family. Today's students are digital natives, juniors and seniors in high school are so comfortable learning with technology. This brings up my concern with Senate Bill 84's limitations with online classes. We've already heard, but it bears repeating, that Senate Bill 84, Section 23A said, courses offered through an accelerated program may be supported by online resources, but of course may not be exclusively online, which was then changed. Senate Bill 84.1, Section 23A says, but a course provided exclusively online must be supported by in-person activities targeted to improving the success of students in these courses. I am questioning the thought that has been placed in this bill regarding online courses. As a mother who has numerous children using online courses and have seen great success, I propose the question today of why. Why would we want to make it more difficult and challenging for our children to get an education when our world is working so hard to make our lives flexible and accessible? The pace of life is fast. The largest challenge we face, from my perspective today, is the ability to continue to move forward. The greater good that we bring to our children is choice, choice in their education. Our goal should be to give them jetpacks, not put rocks in their backpacks. The pathway to their future is through technology. I believe that everyone here knows that this is, or could be, one of those moments when we are influencing our future. The explosion in college-level online courses shows that the students' demand is growing. Here's some interesting facts that I found from Babson College in 2014. There are approximately 3.8 million students enrolled in full-time education learning. 95% of higher ed schools
with more than 5,000 students have offered distant learning. 71% of the higher ed chief academic leaders report that online learning is critical to their long-term strategy. Obviously, educators across the country are looking to extend students' access to online courses. My belief is that Oregon needs to keep moving forward and not step back. Thanks.
Thank you.
Senator Roblin, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Jeff Dentz, professor of political science at Eastern Oregon University and president of the Interinstitutional Faculty Senate. We represent the faculty of Oregon's public universities. There are several issues with Senate Bill 84's language that may inhibit its potential effectiveness. Senate Bill 84 stipulates, quote, faculty at post-secondary institutions of education will collaborate with teachers and school districts to ensure the quality of the accelerated learning program and to ensure alignment of the content, objectives, and outcomes of individual courses, end quote. This provision raises a range of academic quality and workload-related issues that may adversely impact Senate Bill 84 to benefit the best interest of our most valuable resource, our students. First, a number of Oregon's public universities have legally binding collective bargaining agreements protecting the best interest of both faculty and institution. Senate Bill 84's current language lacks specificity as to how faculty participation in accelerated learning programs, especially dual credit, will be integrated into the contractual workload of public university faculty in Oregon. Second, Senate Bill 84's dual credit provisions may have the potential to adversely affect academic quality in Oregon's public universities, as faculty may confront the need to dedicate more and more time to accelerated learning activities at the cost of their current students. Quote, ensuring the quality of accelerated learning programs, end quote, will be a time-intensive activity. Hence, a thoughtful consideration of the overlay between Senate Bill 84's goals and faculty resources necessary for success may be in need of further reflection and refinement. Senate Bill 84 raises several other issues, including but not limited to the ability of small rural schools to deliver the stipulated number of college credits on a regular basis, the mechanics of the approval process for high school teachers that are part of an accelerated learning program, and, as we've heard today, limitations on online courses based on my 15-plus years of experience in teaching in an online environment. These issues have the ability to adversely affect academic quality in higher education, a value that all members of IFS have made a solemn oath to uphold. While IFS greatly appreciates the legislature's and OEIB's attempt to address college readiness and preparation in an innovative manner, we would suggest an expansion of support for advanced placement and international baccalaureate programs may be a more effective option to address college readiness and preparation in Oregon. Enhancing teacher preparation support for AP courses and providing scholarships for students to engage in international baccalaureate tests have the potential to avert some of the unintended consequences associated with Senate Bill 84. IFS suggests additional state support for advanced placement and international baccalaureate may be a wise investment for Oregon. The Interinstitutional Faculty Senate firmly believes in the centrality of the overarching principles of access and affordability in pursuit of the state's ambitious 40-40-20 goal. Senate Bill 84's attempt to significantly improve college readiness for future Oregon students in a cost-effective manner that protects the bedrock principle of academic quality may be in need of further refinement. Thank you for your time. I'd be glad to answer any questions you may have.
Yes, Senator Cruz.
Just a comment, because this has been a struggle when we entered into the field of online courses for high school and trying to ensure that the rigor was in the coursework without tasking the teachers or the schools with having to do that, because that is a big job. And we tasked the Department of Ed with doing that, and they've kind of fallen short of that goal. So I think that's got to be a big issue in this, is that there needs to be some central place that does this so that it's kind of a universal system. So
thank you. Any other thoughts or whatever? Thank you all for being here. It is appreciated. Next, we have Anne Marie Gurney. Looks like Christina, Joel Byrne. I hope I can. Okay, thank you.
That air conditioning
is refreshing. We've got two left. Okay. We'll just have you two to begin with, and then we have two more.
Hi.
Hi.
Chair Roblin, members of the committee, my name is Anne Marie Gurney, and I am a parent of two students with Oregon Connections Academy. I'm also on the board of the Oregon Connections Academy Parents Association, speaking for and representing over 3,900 students statewide. And I am here to more or less toot the horn of this lovely lady back here, Allison Galvin, who you heard speak earlier. And the amount of, and this might speak to what Senator Cruz just brought up, the tremendous amount of work and effort she put into creating and forging the relationship between Oregon Connections Academy and Lane Benton Community College to achieve exactly what Senator Cruz was saying, that level of excellence, that level of high quality, that level of engagement for the students, and as well as oversight, not just students clicking buttons on a computer, but having a rigorous program where students are supported. She did that out of the goodness of her heart, and she did that because she wants excellence and to grow opportunities for students. And as a result, you heard it. In 3 years' time, almost 1,800 credits have been given. Students who normally wouldn't have opportunities to go to college now do. And rural community-served students are having open opportunities as well. And so I just want to toot her horn because it's teachers like her that who look at their profession and love their profession so much that they're not looking for extra pay, they're not looking for recognition, so I'm going to give it to her here today. They're looking for how to grow a student's, grow opportunities for students. And so, and so I'm here in pro to speak in pro of the Dash 3 amendments, which would allow teachers like her to continue to do this, continue creating excellent programs, and also to toot her horn because she won't do it for her. So I stand here as a representative of the Oregon Connections Academy Parents Association and just ask for your support on the Dash 3 amendments. Thank you.
Thank you.
Hi, Senator Roblin, members of the committee. My name is Christina Sturig-Bond, and I teach at the Metro East Webb Academy, and I am a dual credit instructor in an online environment. I think a lot of what I was going to say has already been said, so I think I'll just sort of tell from my perspective what I do. I am an online instructor. I've been doing this now for 5 years. 5 years ago, I went through a screening through Mount Hood Community College, and they looked at my education, they looked at my publications, and they said, yes, you can teach community college courses. I've been doing it since then. I took a class through Mount Hood Community College, which taught me how to put curriculum online, and I took that with other faculty members. So I am as qualified, I would say, as community college instructors to teach these courses. We have a great relationship with Mount Hood Community College. It used to be that our students were charged $35 a head for the dual credit courses, and that has been done away with. There is no charge for dual credit courses right now through Mount Hood Community College. The courses I teach are exactly like the Mount Hood Community College courses. They use the same curriculum. They use the same syllabus. They use the same learning outcomes. They use the same required texts. It is essentially the same course. We even use the same schedule. So even though we are a school that has a semester schedule, our dual credit courses work on the 10-week schedule. So my Writing 121 course, there are three essays due, one collaborative essay due, and it's in 10 weeks. It's rigorous. It's intense. And these are 16, 17-year-old kids who are doing this. We feel like not only are we preparing students, our high school students, for college courses, we're also preparing them for online courses. As you know, lots of universities and colleges now have online courses. And if students can take that already at the high school level, they're going to be prepared to take them and to succeed in them at the college level. Areas that we're preparing them are how to be intrinsically motivated, how to organize time, how to be that kid who gets online and gets it done without someone saying, you have to do this now and turn it in now. We're also preparing students how to comport themselves online, how to be responsible in the discussion boards, how to be responsible through email, how to be responsible with their fellow colleagues or fellow peers through discussion, through online and email discussions. We're also preparing them on how to work collaboratively online, which is a trick, you know, that's a little bit different. And how do you do that, and how are you successful with that? And we do that in our college now, or our dual credit courses. We also are teaching them how to navigate the system. So every LMS is slightly different, every learning management system is slightly different, and yet if they've done it once, they're gonna have a better chance of doing it well the second time when they get to the university level. Our students are mainly at risk. 60 to 70% of the students at our school would be considered at risk. I know Dr. Gray spoke to that earlier, but we have a lot of kids who come to us credit deficient, and we are helping them make that step from being behind to being ahead and being able to go to college. And without that opportunity, many of these kids aren't going to end up at college. So we feel like these dual credit classes are very important to their success.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Any questions? Okay. Thanks.
Thank you.
And the last two people on our list are John Wyckoff and Joel Fisher.
Chair Roblin, members of the committee, for the record, my name is John Wyckoff with the Oregon Community College Association. Here to give a few comments on Senate Bill 84. I will be as brief as I can. We're very supportive of accelerated learning opportunities and hope to be a constructive voice in creating more opportunities for students looking for college-level courses and to get further prepared for a college education. But we want to make sure that the bill really focuses on students that are college ready. I mean, one of the things that we do have a concern about is if you put students in a college level course who really aren't prepared for it, what you really could be doing is making them even less motivated. If they aren't successful in that course because they weren't actually college ready students, it may actually be a disincentive for them to want to move forward in college or make them think that they aren't ready for something like that. And so we want to make sure that students that we're focusing on really can be successful in this kind of and work with this rigor. Another issue we want to make sure is not overlooked is the impact it could have on financial aid for students. If students are taking coursework that may not be in the major that they will be going into at college or a university, they could run out of financial aid. And so we just want to make sure that students are able to sort of plan for that and know that you want to be taking courses that would probably lead to a major that you might think that you would be looking toward. I think a lot has been said about online learning, and we probably share the concerns that some folks have brought up about online learning and it not being or the prohibition on it. And we agree that removing that prohibition on online learning or at least adjusting it would be helpful. But I think a lot has been said on that, so I won't go further into it. And the last issue for us is that we do have some concerns around the changes for certification of teachers and how that might interact with accreditation for the community colleges. We just want to make sure that we aren't going to run afoul of our accreditors if we're being asked to credential teachers that an accreditor may not think is qualified by our accreditation standards.
Thank you
very much.
Chair Joel. Roblin, members of the committee, my name is Joel Fisher here on behalf of Oregon Business Association. We're a statewide association representing over 300 members across Oregon, from some of Oregon's largest companies to small Main Street businesses. Education is one of our top priorities as a business association because a well-educated citizenry is necessary for an excellent workforce. We're in support of the accelerated learning dual credit as just, you know, one piece of our broader education agenda. I think everybody's already exhausted the many good reasons for you to support this. The one I would like to highlight is that an accelerated learning or dual credit program can really make college real for some students. I'm embarrassed to say that I wouldn't have gone to college myself if it weren't for my parents sitting me down and making me fill out the application to Oregon State University. It just didn't seem real to me. And I wasn't motivated to do it myself. And for a lot of students who, you know, don't come from households, they might come from a household where they are the first person to be going to college. It just doesn't seem real. And accelerated learning dual credits is one of those things that can make that possibility seem real for people. And we would urge your support.
Thank you. Any questions? Yes, Senator.
No, I'd say football scholarships help too.
Oh, yeah. Okay. Anything? Well, thank you very much. We're going to close our public. Well, is there anyone else that wanted to speak to Senate Bill 84? We're going to close the public hearing on Senate Bill 84. We're going to open a public hearing on Senate Bill 519. We've heard this bill before as well. And we sent some people back to do some work. And so right now we're going to, in that public hearing, did I open the public hearing? We'll open a public hearing for 519. I'm going to call up Lori Wimmer, John Wyckoff. Yep, that's pretty much it, to see where we are. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and committee members. For your record, excuse me, Lori Wimmer, representing Oregon Education Association. It's 42,000 members. As we told you last week, we have a negotiated agreement, which is found in the amendments that you have before you. About 5 minutes before your committee met today, I learned that there was a little bit of a fiscal attached to it, too. So I would anticipate that you're probably going to want to refer it to Ways and Means, and we've already talked with the co-chairs about that. So with that, we hope that you will pass out the amended version to the floor by way of...
Chair Roblin, members of the committee, for the record, John Wyckoff, Oregon Community College Association. And I can't speak for CCWD, who is providing the fiscal impact statement, but I haven't spoken to CCWD. And essentially, they moved from one database to a new database system, the D4A database that they're using now. And when they were were prioritizing what they could and couldn't do in the new system, this fell off the list. They didn't have enough funding to continue providing the external data in the way they were, and so feel that it would require, I believe, a fiscal impact of about $30,000 to do that. OCCA is very supportive of this information being available and of the department having the resources to do it. So we very much hope that should this require a little bit of funding, that funding come forward, because this is the kind of information that CCWD needs to have the resources to be able to provide.
Okay. And yes, Senator Cruz.
In a universe where we're underfunding community colleges, I think if we're going to require this, we pay for it.
I think anybody, if we're thinking it's important, and I need to talk to the sponsor of the bill and have that kind of conversation before I move it. So I appreciate your willingness to get together and come up with a compromise that seems to work. And we will, is there anyone else that would like to speak to this? Seeing no one, we're going to close the public hearing on this, on Senate Bill 519, and we are not going to have a work session today, but if we can get that agreed and the amounts and those kinds of things, and if it needs to go to Ways and Means, we will come back with a work session only. With that, we're going to open a public hearing on Senate Bill 447. And again, we can have we heard this bill before too. This was Senator Devlin's bill that has to do with dual funding. Morgan Allen from OSBA, if you could come up forward, we'd love to have you in the public hearing.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. For the record, Morgan Allen from the Oregon School Boards Association, and we hope you will give consideration to the -5 amendments to Senate Bill 447, which is the School Facilities Task Force recommendations from the last interim. And if you'd like, I could briefly explain what the -5 amendments do. They actually do three things. So I'm on page 1 of the -5 amendments. Lines 3 through 6, during the process of drafting the bill, we discovered that when the legislature created, if you remember, the Cool Schools legislation from a few pioneers ago.
Yeah,
I remember.
Okay. There was actually something written into Cool Schools that requires that any monies from Article 11P bonds, which this bill proposes selling $125 million worth of, if you do anything to a building that money touches, that building has to be minimally LEED silver certified, which could add significant cost. So, for example, if you got some matching funds from the state and you were replacing roofs and repairing HVAC systems, you'd have to bring that whole building up to LEED standards. And so I actually talked to former State Representative Jules Bailey, who's now Multnomah County Commissioner, and told him that we were going to remove this, and he agreed that that was an unintended part of the Cool Schools legislation. And so that lines 3 through 6 exempt the monies in this bill from that provision. The second issue that came up, this is really lines 9 through 15 on page 1 of the amendment. The task force recommended that the grants be between $2 and $8 million. So the idea is that everybody could get something, but big districts like Portland or Beaverton or Salem-Keizer wouldn't eat up all the money. And so we heard from actually quite a few smaller and medium-sized districts that had some concerns that that $2 million was a little bit too low to be able to sell that to their community. So the task force members had a conversation and agreed to raise that floor essentially to $4 million. But in order to get more than $4 million, there's a formula that would determine essentially what your property value and how many students of poverty, and you could potentially get more money if your district is has a lower tax base and a higher number of students in poverty. So it's the same formula, same idea. They just raised the floor a little bit. I'll give you the perfect example. Grant County, which is John Day's school district, that they would have only maybe qualified for about $2.5 million out of that. And I talked to their superintendent, and there were some other districts too, I believe Yonkala and a few other school districts that talked to us and basically said, we don't think that that's high enough to go sell a $15 or $20 million bond to our voters. So that's why that is increased. And then the third thing is really a technical adjustment. This is on page 3 of the amendment. Currently in the state school fund, there's a carve out for $20 million for facilities matching grants. And that predates the constitutional change that allows school districts to furnish and buy computers and desks and other things with their bond proceeds. And so when that was changed, this is still in the state school fund. And it currently sets aside $20 million of biennium. And the state school fund, the task force, the facilities task force, proposed repurposing $6 million to open the Office of School Facilities at the Department of Ed, provide the grants for school districts that need to have architects or other folks come out and assess their buildings. And so in the original version, it inadvertently took the whole $20 million and gave it to that part of the bill. That was not the intention of the task force. And there are districts, including Bend, Lapine, others, that are anticipating that there's going to be money available this biennium for bonds and buildings already in the pipeline. So they wanted to make sure that there's still some money in there for some of those districts that were anticipating some proceeds for that. So that just clarifies that. And with that, I would be happy to answer any questions.
So any questions on? Yes, Senator Cruz.
Just the formula that's going to be used, I'm assuming that will be developed at a later date?
Senator Beyer and Senator Haas, or excuse me, Chair Robel and Senator, my brain's not working.
You're doing okay.
Senator Cruz.
Same everybody.
Just whoever. That's right. Senator Shonson, whatnot.
Long way from me over to there. Yeah,
right. Well, he's a new kid. I mean, he's never been here before. So.
I've only been doing this.
Say this name here.
I've only been doing this for 8 years. That's probably the worst flub I've ever had by far.
I don't know. Maybe. Yeah,
nice sunburn, by the way. So.
Senator Cruz, the formula that the task force recommended, it's very similar to the local option equalization grant formula. Brian Reeder and some of the other people on task force that are smarter than I am will develop that. But essentially, it takes, you know, how many students you have, what is your property tax value, how many students in poverty, and you would qualify for more than $4 million, essentially, if your district is has less property wealth and more students in poverty. That's how you would move up in that formula. So to get more than everyone who qualifies and is awarded a grant would be guaranteed up to $4 million. In order to get to $4 million, it's essentially greater need, greater matching grant.
Okay, greater match rate. So what you're talking about is what counts as match other than just a levy.
Correct. So, for example, your school district went out, you were awarded a grant, and you went out and passed a $15 million bond.
Right.
You'd be guaranteed $4 million. You could potentially get up to $8 million.
Okay. That does make it easier to sell.
Yes.
Right. And I had a number of talks with small school districts who said, there's hardly anything I can build anymore with $4 million. And so, doubling, you know,
right,
it's really tough. So, $8 million was kind of what they came in at, and that's why the four. And I tend to agree with that. So that's
where they came from.
So any other questions or comments from our witness? Thank you. I'll close our public hearing on Senate Bill 447. This does have a referral, right, to Ways and Means? Okay, that's what I figured. Because we'll have to figure out if there's any money for it. So I would we'll open a work session on Senate Bill 447. And I would love to hear an emotion with respect
to the
amendment.
An emotion?
I can put emotion into it as well.
Yeah. Put emotion into your motion.
Because I was faint today on the floor.
That's right.
So. Chair Roblin, I move to adopt the Dash 5 amendments as presented.
Senator Canope moves to adopt the Dash 5 amendments as presented. Is there any discussion?
He didn't really have much emotion.
We'll get better on the next one. Seeing is no discussion, is there any opposition to either one? Seeing none, it is adopted. Now, let's go on.
Esteemed Chair Roblin.
Oh, that's better.
I move Senate Bill 447 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation and that the bill be referred to the Joint Committee on Ways and Means by prior reference.
Senator Canope moves Senate Bill 447 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation and that it be referred to the Joint Committee on Ways and Means by prior reference. Is there any discussion? Seeing none. Is there any opposition? Seeing none. It is adopted. So we will send it on to Ways and Means, and we don't need a carrier.
No. Oh,
that's really nice. I didn't forget that then. So that we will then close the work session on Senate Bill 447. We're going to open a public hearing on Senate Bill 473. We do have some ongoing work that needs to be done, so this one is not going to have a work session today. We had hoped that it might be ready today. So we'll have John Wyckoff.
And Mario,
where are you? Yes, thanks. Both of you, come on up.
Still working on that. Sure. Thank you, Mr. Chair. For the record, my name is Mario Parker Milligan. I'm the Legislative Director with the Oregon Student Association. I'd like to thank Mr. Wyckoff for working with us to develop amendments. I'm confident we'll have those ready for your review in the next couple of days, but we're not ready to show them today.
Chair Roblin, members of the committee, for the record, John Wyckoff, Oregon Community College Association, and we have drafted amendments that I have shared with the Oregon Student Association and Basic Rights Oregon, and essentially what we are trying to do is give the Higher Education Coordinating Commission a little more explicit flexibility on timeline. And then there's a report back, actually, as well, to talk about to the degree that this has been implemented and what and if there were barriers to the implementation of it and what they were. And so I think we all feel confident that we will get there, but are still in process of refining our amendment.
And I hope everybody, yes. Senator Canope, question.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. John, I talked to my community college. They indicated that if they were to have to change something in their tracking system as it relates to adding a field, that that's a minimum of $20,000 and that there tends to be a cascading effect as it relates to that. So is there anything that you can tell me as it relates to either that's not going to be necessary or that there's going to be some sort of fiscal attached to this bill that covers that cost?
Chair Rowan, Senator Canope. So our amendment is intended to minimize that kind of impact by giving the HEC the flexibility to allow the colleges time to work it into their systems and to look at different approaches to doing that. As I had said in my testimony previously, many of our colleges are on the banner system for this kind of information, but especially our smaller colleges are on RogueNet, and those may be the ones where it may be a bit more difficult to change. The system overall costs them less. But this kind of change might be a bit more difficult. But we believe that the flexibility that we're trying to work in at the Higher Education Coordinating Commission will alleviate some of that.
And we will have time when we get the amendment. We will post it quickly so we can get back to our community colleges and others to see if they believe it is worth that deal as well. So, any other questions of these two witnesses? No, thank you very much, both of you. And we do have Jeff Dents, also with IFS, who wanted to speak to this one.
Thank you.
Good
Chair Roblin, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Jeff Dins, president of the Interinstitutional Faculty Senate and professor of political science at Eastern University. We represent the faculty at Oregon's public university. IFS supports the principles of inclusiveness and access for all in higher education in Oregon. Senate Bill 473 is requiring all higher ed institutions to allow students, faculty, and staff to change their first names and self-identify sexual orientation on forms used to collect demographic data sends a clear and convincing message to the LGBT community that the state of Oregon continues to stand for the core value of inclusiveness in higher education. In order to promote the successful implementation of the letter and spirit of Senate Bill 473, IFS would offer two suggestions rooted in best practices for the committee to contemplate. First, universities nationwide, in particular Tufts, Duke, and Oregon, provide students the opportunity to fill in their gender on housing and or admission applications as opposed to a checking the box reporting strategy. This fill-in format evades the pigeonholing of preoperative transsexual students, faculty, and staff. Secondly, IFS considers the University of Wisconsin to be a leader in preferred first name best practice, as students, faculty, and staff can unilaterally indicate a preferred first name to appear alongside or instead of a legal name. IFS urges the committee to consider this alongside option, as the current language of Senate Bill 473 does not indicate this option is available. While in, after conversations with stakeholders, we understand the implementation issues with the current draft, IFS supports the bedrock principle of access for all Oregonians contained in Senate Bill 473. Along with affordability, access is one of the linchpins of the state's ambitious 40-40-20 goals and is consistent with Title IX and Oregon's anti-discrimination laws. Taking on a new name and being allowed the freedom to self-report one's sexual identity is often the first step in an individual's transition towards living in accordance with their gender identity. Senate Bill 473 is an important first step in ensuring an inclusive higher education community in Oregon. Thank you. I'd be glad to answer any questions you may have.
Yes, Senator Cruz.
You make a couple good points there. I would suggest if there are other universities or systems that have got it figured out, why should we be inventing something and just copy what's working, just as a thought?
Chair Roblin, Senator Cruz, thank you for your question. I think knowing a little bit of working knowledge with regard to the systems in place at the schools, I think there are some implementation costs affiliated with either one of these options. But as I previously mentioned, I really like the model that the University of Wisconsin's using in providing students a choice in terms of their reporting.
Mr. Chair, there's going to be implementation costs no matter what we do. So, but the thought, my thought is, if there's something that they've already got the bugs worked out of the system, that would be certainly a good place to look, I would think.
Yep. So, I agree. The issue is, what software program are we using in both places? If they're not the same, it might make it harder. And I think that's where your implementation problem is coming from. And I think that's where the issue is coming from.
Certainly worth a look, I would think.
I agree.
Okay. We're getting nods. So
thank you. So we will close our public hearing on Senate Bill 473. And as we know, we're not ready for a work session. So, with that, is there any other information that wants to come to the committee? Then we will adjourn our Senate Education Committee. Thank you very much.
I'll just add another good day.
Why reinvent the wheel if it's already invented?
Another one down.
Did I roll over it?
Okay. My apologies.
No problem.
Have fun at our committee.
Check the newspaper tonight.
We are. You'll be amazed at the number of bills we're going to
pass. I've been there a lot.
Oh,
I'm excited to go to prison.
Yeah.
We just did.
I've been there. Well, I see. I've been there.
I haven't. See, these filters are all new.
I've been there.
I haven't. See.